you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hi, my name is Danny Roth, and this is Everyday Horror. It's a podcast where we watch at least one horror movie for every day in the month of October, and then we talk about it. Today, I am joined by Jamie Moore, who is the host of Needs More Gay. Hello, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm doing really good. So you picked a movie. What is the movie that you picked?
So I picked Oculus, which is a movie from 2013. I actually watched this movie in theaters when it came out. And I think what really attracted me to it was that I liked the, well, at least judging from the commercial, I liked the idea of people fighting a horror monster through empirical evidence. Like basically, like setting up, you know, studies, it's a study, like what are the rules of the monster? What can it do? And like basically like studying it and kind of fighting it through that. Which I think this movie kind of does, even though it doesn't quite. That's not really the full like direction of it, but that was at least what it seemed like. That's the impression I got from it at first. I think that's what first attracted me to it.
It's a really interesting movie. I came to it for, I think, the same reason that a lot of people did, which is that I was a really big Doctor Who fan, and I still am, and Karen Gillan was in it, and I really like her.
I do like her. I have actually not seen enough Doctor Who to, I have not seen any of the Doctor Who that she's in. But I do like her a lot. And obviously she's great in Guardians of the Galaxy. She's really good in this movie, I think.
Yeah, she's fantastic. And I think what's sort of interesting about it is that, I mean, I suppose in a way she had some degree of fame, but I don't think like the whole world knew who she was. I definitely think like, you know, like nerds knew, but yeah, I don't think she hadn't become like Marvel movie big, which is a completely different category. But sure. The movie, what's interesting about it is that it does have a particular pedigree. So it was directed and I think co-written by Mike Flanagan, who had done Absentia before that and has now gone on to do a lot of pretty big things. In my mind. So he edited a movie called Hush, which is from the perspective of a deaf woman. It's like a home invasion story. Before I Wake, he also edited, and I think might have directed, the second Ouija movie, a.k.a. The Good One. Hmm. Yeah, and he did Gerald's Game, and he's doing Dr. Sleep, which is sort of like, it's like a sequel to The Shining, kind of.
Interesting.
Yeah, so he's got a lot to his background. And the other thing about Oculus is that, like the movie Lights Out, it was originally a short before it then became a feature-length film. Had you ever seen the short prior to this?
I didn't see it. I actually saw the short after I saw this. And as I recall, basically the short is basically just a guy. It's more or less just a guy talking into a camera. It's more or less like just the sort of experiment portion of what we see here.
Yeah. So the basic concept of the short is a guy who, I guess, ostensibly lost his parents, perhaps as a result of this mirror, has it brought into a private space where he is going to watch and prove that the mirror was the reason why his parents did what they did, which is to say kill each other. And in the process, things don't really go very well for him. And it was like a half an hour short. So it's a little different from Lights Out in that Lights Out short was like a YouTube phenomenon. Like that was like a couple minutes long and was so popular that it then turned into a movie. Whereas this had kind of sat in the background for, I think, quite a while, if memory serves. In fact, let me look it up really quickly. But it was like the earlier mid-2000s that they had come up with that concept and filmed it, and then they didn't make Oculus until 2013. So it was like a little while. It was a couple of years. So it was kind of an idea that they thought was really worth making into a feature length. They spent, I think, a fair amount of time pitching it around, like as happens, spent many years trying to make this thing happen, even I think before he had done Absentia. So is there anything about this movie, content wise, that people should be aware of before we talk about it and before they watch it?
I mean, there are definitely some depictions of domestic abuse, even if it's a sort of supernaturally inspired domestic abuse. It definitely reads as domestic abuse. I'm not sure what else we would have a warning for necessarily.
Yeah, I don't have any serious ones. I will say that it features some actors who are not American.
Yes.
Doing American accents of if there's anything else. Oh, and Brenton Thwaites is in it. Who's playing Robin on Titans, who said that really
is
mean
he,
thing
is
about
that the
Batman.
Guy? Oh man, I didn't realize that was the same guy.
That's who that is. Yeah. I'm surprised by that. This is before we go into the movie, like one of the things that is sort of, I remember being kind of not a big deal, but something that people did talk about before and then after the film came out, is that Brenton Thwaites is an out bisexual actor.
Did not know that.
Yeah. So that was a thing that, like, I guess, like, didn't get discussed a ton, but exactly enough because, you know, like, not everybody is out. Like, that's like, out bisexual is not always the most common thing in the world. So, yeah. Anyway, so yeah, it's Karen Gillan, Brenton Thwaites, Katie Sackhoff from Battlestar Galactica, and Rory Cochrane from Empire Records.
The other thing that really attracted me to this is that I've always been a big fan of the sort of like one location thriller, which this movie kind of is. Like, I mean, obviously, most of it basically takes place in a house. And I guess we don't get the perfect sense of like the layout of the house necessarily, but most of it does take place within at least one set, more or less.
It is, yeah. It is largely, so they filmed, I think it was like Alabama or something. They filmed cheap. They did use that one location for the most part. And then I think they had like one other set that they used that sort of represented the house just for some pickups. And they came back. That's another interesting thing about this movie is that they filmed the movie and then had to come back. They were lucky enough. They were able to get everybody that they needed to come back and do like a couple of pickup shots that added a lot of clarity that had been missing. But Karen Gillan had done something to her hair and they had to give her like fake bangs and stuff.
Interesting.
This is how movies get made. Yeah. I also really like when a movie it's kind of like a ship in a bottle episode of a TV show almost.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're trying to deal with as little as possible. And what I think is really important about them using primarily one set is that while that can make things simple, they made everything else really hard for themselves because I would say one of the most core conceits of the film is that we are constantly going back and forth between two different time periods, and it becomes more and more frequent from act to act.
Yeah. So it's I guess we kind of run down the plot of the movie. It's almost kind of like a horror movie intercut with its own sequel a little bit.
And we have
two kind of storylines. There's the kind of flashback to 2002, which is what are the characters' names even? I don't remember. Karen Gillan.
Kaylee and Tim.
Young Kaylee and Tim. And their parents have moved into a new house, and they've brought this cursed mirror that we don't know is cursed yet. It's almost sort of a The Shining setup, in that everything's just sort of, the mirror itself is just sort of vaguely haunted. Basically, slowly drives their parents crazy, and culminating with Katie Sackhoff, the father kills Katie, the mother played by Katie Sackhoff, and kind of ends up killing him, well, basically sort of manipulating the son into killing him so that he won't kill the kids, I'm telling this out of order a little bit, but it's very confusing.
I mean, the film is told out of order. So like, if I were to take a stab at it, Kaylee Russell, knowing that her brother Tim is getting out of sort of, he's been in a mental ward, at a hospital, has decided that this mirror that is sort of the reason why he has been in that ward and why their parents are dead, she's going to take it. They are going to prove that the mirror is responsible for this tragedy in their past, and they're going to destroy it. That is the plot. And as the film goes on, we flash back more and more to understand specifically what the tragedy was for them in their youth, and indeed to the extent that the past and present become simultaneously. They're happening at the same time, kind of.
And it kind of, they sort of bleed into each other a little bit.
Yeah.
There's actually a moment towards the end that I thought was really interesting where the young version of Tim sees the older version. And for a second, I thought there was going to be like a time travel element going on there, but didn't quite pay off that way. But I think it was more just kind of show that there was sort of this, you know, the sort of the timelines were sort of overlapping a little bit.
Well, and there's no way I like a thing I like in addition to the idea that they really use this one steady space in order to give us the continuity we need as we're traveling through time. Once the mirror is there, and once it's being shown, once it's actually like in its home, you can't trust anything that anyone says or does or anything that you see.
Yeah, so kind of the whole conceit with the mirror is that it doesn't actually kill people. It basically manipulates perception and basically tricks people into killing each other and themselves.
Yeah. And the other thing that I really like about it is that it's never actually called a mirror. We keep saying that, but it is called a glass. It is specifically called the Lasser glass, which I love. And a thing that we'll talk about towards the end of this is that there had been an intention at one point that this was kind of be like a legacy thing. They were going to make more movies with different people all dealing with the Lasser glass, which I'm kind of bummed just because it's called the Lasser glass and I love that. I don't know why, but I just think that name is really,
it is a good, very like evocative name.
Yeah.
The Lasser glass.
I kind of want to talk about, do you remember the marketing for this movie? The stuff that they showed before it was out in theaters.
Was it one of those ones where it's like, these are like the reactions from people in the audience?
I think they showed a little bit of that. There was one specific sequence that they showed that I think they decided was going to be representative of what you were in for.
Was it were you talking about Karen Gillan biting into the light bulb?
Yes.
Yeah, I definitely remember that being the, like, yes, that being sort of a central element of the marketing.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting about that is twofold. One, I mean, I do think it does a very effective job. She thinks that she's taking a bite of an apple, but then, in fact, she is taking a bite of this light bulb instead. And that is great because it's not actually spoiling the film because, in fact, in the movie, she did take a bite of an apple. It's just that it's that many layers of an evil mirror messing with her. And the other thing that's interesting about that is that was the sequence itself was in the script. But there was a producer that came in and said, no, there needs to be more blood. Huh. Like, that was not in the original. So their original intention had not been to show her, like, because she pulls, like, this piece of glass from her mouth and there's all this blood coming out. And they did not want that and apparently had a big fight with producers saying that they didn't want that to happen, which I think is interesting. Do you think it would have been, this is sort of like, how much do you show and how much do you not? Like, do you have a response to whether or not you think that the blood was necessary, or do you think it's better with or without?
I don't know. I'm trying to imagine how that scene would have played out without the blood, and I guess I don't know. I'm not sure it makes a huge difference to me. I definitely, like, I remember when that marketing was going on, I remember making a joke that, like, what if the whole movie was just people accidentally eating light bulbs? Like, that was just the only thing the mirror did, was just like, oh God. All right, let's try this. Let's go down to the basement. But first, let me eat this apple. Oh God, it's another light bulb.
God,
I think that would have been excellent.
Yeah. See, it's called the Lasser glass because it's always making you eat glass.
Yes, it just tricks you into eating glass. That's all it does.
Yeah, it's like it's a one party trick.
I think in general, this movie is there isn't that much violence to it, really. I mean, apart, obviously, like. people get killed. But I wouldn't say like it focuses more on mood than it does gore. But I guess the gore does kind of help just make it clear that there are stakes, you know, that like the mirror can like there is actual like, you know, people's healths are at risk here.
Yeah, I think so. There's also it's a psychological horror movie, and it does deal with mental health.
Mm-hmm.
To a degree, in that it begins with Tim getting out of a mental facility where he's been for ostensibly like I think his whole young life. I don't think we're meant to suggest that he's ever been out.
Yeah, that he had basically been there since I guess he was what 10 when the in 2002.
Yeah, so he's been there the whole time. He has no real concept of what the real world is like outside of where he's been staying in this ward. There's actually a scene that they deleted where he goes to buy a cell phone and doesn't really understand how cell phones work anymore, which I thought was kind of interesting. Not necessary to the film, but once you know about it, you could see why they thought it would be a good idea to include.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're dealing with his kind of mental illness and that he's dealing with, I guess, a post-traumatic stress. And then we're dealing with the parents, Marie and Alan Russell, played by Katie Sackhoff and Rory Cochrane. And that is, I think, much thornier. And I think one of the challenges where I'm not sure the film always succeeds is dealing with the idea that there is some kind of abuse happening, the spousal abuse, and therefore also child abuse. Mm-hmm. These are really complex topics. And since only part of the film is spent there, and there's also a supernatural element that they're trying to use as a means to have like a shorthand and do the heavy lifting, I'm not sure it always works.
Yeah. So like, I mean, in the first part of the movie, like it's kind of like when the brother and sister are kind of, you know, first kind of like making this plan for a fair portion of it, it's basically Kaylee trying to convince him that this really happened. And he's basically insisting that, you know, this was we were kids. You know, this was an illusion we kind of created for ourselves. And, you know, that our parents were abusive. And we eventually find out that, no, they weren't really abusive. There was just this ghost forcing them to do things. And there's something, I'm not sure what, because you get this sort of abuse storyline, and then there's this sort of supernatural explanation for it. And I'm not sure what that says about the reality of abuse, necessarily.
Yeah, like, I'm not sure if they're trying to say anything, but the fact is it's there.
Yeah.
And so as a result, I think anybody watching it is going to have a response.
Sure.
So that I do think that's kind of challenging. But yeah, I think that one of the great successes of the film, and they've talked about this, the two writers, they specifically set out for Kaylee and Tim to be in kind of a Mulder Scully situation.
Mm-hmm.
Wherein, you know, one of them really wants to believe and the other one's is a skeptic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is important because it's kind of like that meta narrative of horror. You set up the rules and then you have to prove that the rules are true.
Mm-hmm.
Because Kaylee spends all this time explaining, like she pulls Tim into their childhood home. They've got the Lasser glass. She's got all of these Apple products everywhere, it's kind of set up to record everything, and she gives this very long-winded speech about how the Lasser glass works so that we understand the rules. And the rules are, it doesn't come after the strongest first, it'll kill plants, it'll kill animals, and it does weaken things. Like that is sort of an element of the story, which is that it is in a way feasting on life.
Yeah.
Like not necessarily a direct kill, but you have to make sure that you're reminded to eat and drink. I think they cite one particular person who owned the Lasser glass that was like 300 pounds. And then when he died, he was like less than 100 pounds.
Yeah.
And there was a woman who stayed in a bath and still died of dehydration.
Yeah. Seems to also mess with your perception of time to some extent.
Yeah. So this is, yeah, there's all of these sort of layers that they set up as far as how the rules work. And then they, yeah, they start to prove them one by one in very interesting ways. So, for example, she's trying to, you know, make sure that there's always all this recording equipment on the Lasser Glass. And they come into a room, they leave the room, and then they come back, and all of the stuff has been moved away. It's mm-hmm. everything's recording itself. Nothing's recording the Lasser Glass. And when she goes back to look and figure out how that happened, it was actually her and Tim. They're the ones that moved everything, but they have no memory of having done it.
Yeah. Which to me at that point, I mean, like on a logical level, like at that point you kind of realize, okay, we can't actually, like if we can't trust our own recording equipment at this point, we can't really prove anything. And maybe we should just focus on destroying the mirror, but they don't seem to quite catch on to that.
But they all, so this is interesting, right? Because they, in a way they do, in a way they don't. Mm-hmm. There is a moment wherein Kelly's like, I had to destroy it. And Tim does pick up like a stool, and then he ends up putting it down. And she's like, why did you put down the stool? And yeah. I think once we hit the point wherein he sees that their actions are not their own, he thinks that he's run out of the house to make a telephone call, but he has not actually run out of the house.
Yeah.
And at that point, we know that, like, no matter what they think they're doing, the Lasser Glass is not going to let them leave, at the very least. And that for them to succeed in harming it would be impossible. In fact, there is a point in which they're outside, and they're outside looking into the window, seeing themselves in front of the glass. And one of these other elements is that they've got an anchor that's timed to come down after I forget how much time and destroy the Lasser Glass. But obviously, it's not going to destroy the Lasser Glass. It'll kill them. And they have no idea, are we actually outside or are we actually in there? And there's no way for them to be certain.
Yeah.
So I do think that's sort of how well that works, I suppose, is up to the viewer. I thought that that worked really well in understanding why it is that they can't destroy it, and why they can't just leave, because they can't trust that they've actually left, and they can't trust that they've actually destroyed it.
Once you get to the point where, like, we literally cannot trust anything that we're doing, that we're actually doing any of it, so there really is, like, just kind of no escape at that point. And I guess it almost felt like I wanted them to succeed, I guess, for me, and ultimately they don't, which is unfortunate. But I mean, I guess for me, because I don't know, there is a certain, like, there's a fable there that, you know, I feel like Kaylee in particular is really sort of punished for her, I guess, I don't know, desire for revenge, it feels like. And I wanted her to get it.
No, well, I think, so this is sort of, I think of all of the conversations that I have with people about this film. The third act is always the sticking point, right? Mm-hmm. I've seen reviews where people will say, great movie, except for that third act. And what I think they mean by that third act is that ending.
Yeah.
So I think we can, let's talk about it. I feel like when people talk about this movie, I feel like this is, because I sat down, I was like, oh, let me figure out what it is that people liked and didn't like. And I was like, what was in the zeitgeist of this movie? And I made a horrible mistake, which is that I watched, or tried to watch, the CinemaSins. Everything Wrong with Oculus. Don't do that, by the way, if you're listening to this podcast. It won't. They genuinely, there is a point in which one of their sins is that when Karen Gillan she's in an auction house and she's walking and her ponytail swings back and forth rhythmically. And that was a sin. Considered that a sin. I was like, that was written in the script, and Karen Gillan was like, I can do that. And then she does. And there is something very weird about it that's unsettling and makes you feel not quite safe. And that is literally the whole point of don't watch the CinemaSins review critique of Oculus. But do definitely listen to us talk about the ending and then hear what other people have to say, because that's the most interesting part, I think. All right, so you wanted them to be victorious.
At least on some level. Like the fact that, you know, they do damage the mirror early on, that to me was sort of a suggestion that, okay, there is a possibility of success here. But the ending is it is not optimistic. So basically, so this whole time we've kind of been telling these two stories back and forth, and towards the end, and they really sort of start to kind of fuse together, and that we literally have, you know, the characters are kind of acting out the same events and kind of shifting back and forth between their adult and younger selves. And it basically ends with Kaylee is standing in front of the mirror, kind of being drawn in by this image of her mother. Whereas Tim is she's like, she feels like her, she basically is shown as her child self, and Tim is his adult self in the same room, but they don't see each other. Tim just sees the mirror and basically goes over to the button to drop the anchor, and it does drop down and hits Kaylee, killing her, and leaving the mirror unharmed. At which point the police arrive and arrest him. It's definitely, you know, it fits the story. I guess it's just not the ending I wanted. Mostly, I wanted them to win.
Here is a thing that I found fascinating. I found a review where someone said that they thought the ending was cliche. I am shocked by that. I love this ending specifically because I don't think it's a cliche. I think that it would have been, if they won, that would be nice. And I do think that they certainly set up the possibility of victory, as you said, because, you know, when she first encounters the mirror as an adult, Kelly makes a point of touching that there's a crack along the glass. And she's basically like, you know, like, I bet this still hurts, which is great. It's such a cool way to sort of establish the connection between the character and the object, and also, that this thing is very much alive and is vulnerable, but it's really that it wouldn't be an easy fight. Yeah. So I do think it would have been satisfying because there's basically two ways this ends: either A, they win, or B, they lose, and they certainly set up the possibility, which I like. I think that if they had made it seem from the start that there was no point in this exercise, then there's no reason to have a movie at all.
Yeah.
But what I like about the ending is primarily it's the symmetry. It's that they've been, as you said, they're going back and forth, sort of showing how they've been doing similar things both as children and then as adults. Each time, with in some ways, like as adults, they're slightly more aware, or at least they think they are. The end of their first experience with a laser glass is Tim being taken into a cop car so that they can put him in this facility where he has been this whole time. And then the end of their second experience with the laser glass is Tim being pulled into the police car for ostensibly the last time.
Yeah.
Which is a bummer. This is, so I watched it and I said, I love this ending. And my wife was like, you know, the reason people don't like this is because it's such a goddamn bummer.
Bummer of an ending, but yeah. But yeah, it is very fitting, I feel, in terms of it bookends the movie well.
And what I also like about that is the last thing they sort of intersperse is that they show as he's leaving in the cop car as a child, you see his two parents in the window. And by the way, all of the people that are dead, that have been killed in some way as a result of the glass, have these like mirror eyes. And then as he's leaving as an adult, the parents are still there, but now his sister Kaylee is behind them, and she also has the eyes. I actually, every time I watch it, even talking about it, I get goosebumps. I think it's really well executed.
Yeah, it is a very striking image, definitely.
One last thing I think we should talk about is, as I mentioned earlier, there was the possibility, and they had originally had a little stinger at the end of the credits, which is the laser glass is now back, I guess, at the auction house, and the guy who had been caring for it before Kaylee takes it away is like looking at the glass and touching the one little crack in it, and it suggests that this thing is going to live on and that there were going to be sequels that involved the laser glass. Now, my question to you is thus, do you think it's a shame that they didn't make more of these, or do you think ultimately it's better to stand alone?
I honestly, I would have liked to see more of these for sure. Because I think that this is, it's just a really good premise. Like, there aren't a lot of, I feel like there, I don't know that I've seen another horror movie where basically the monster is perception itself and not, you know, something physically trying to kill you. This is basically the monster is deception, which I thought was really interesting. And I think there would be a lot of potential for that to kind of be seen in other iterations.
Yeah, I agree. I'm kind of bummed that it didn't work out. And also, not just because I think it stands on its own and I think that it is different from everything else, but that also kind of simultaneously, I think that the James Wan horror movies, The Conjuring, Insidious, Annabelle, also deal with these things. Like, there are haunting elements, but also there is a psychological element to those films. And so I don't think that it's so different that it wouldn't fit with where horror movies are now. Like, if you put out an Oculus 2 right now, I think it would succeed. Like, that's, I think it's sort of, it's almost strange. I'm almost baffled. I'm sure there's a reason. I'm sure that some producer somewhere just said, like, nah. Yeah. But I think they made a mistake.
Yeah.
I wish I lived in the universe where they had made more of them. It is. It's such a fascinating idea because we're so used to sequels being built around or as a result of characters, right? Whether whether it's, you know, like a Jason or a Freddy as the villain, or, you know, the Warrens in The Conjuring, which I suppose is like the root of The Conjuring versus that, you know, everything kind of is around the Warren family to some degree.
Yeah.
I like the idea of a cursed object as an antagonist. It's so unusual, and I don't think you really, I just don't think you see that much, you know? I mean, like, it's like if Deathbed, the bed that eats people, was a successful film and they kept making them. I just, you know what I mean? Like, I can't think of a lot of movies where that's how it is. I suppose Annabelle is about as close as it gets, but even then, like, the Annabelle doll is kind of cursed, but it's cursed in that it's haunted. It's like a gateway for a specific demon, which is, I mean, similar, but I think isn't quite the same. And in that way, and I try to end every one of these podcasts with a recommendation. So you liked this movie.
Yeah.
What other movie would you say people should see along with this one? Or in addition to?
When you were mentioning the other work this director has done, I realized that he's done a few other, like, kind of that sort of, you know, one set, one location horror movie. Hush is I think a great example of that, where it's all set in one house, more or less. So that's definitely one I think kind of pairs well with this.
Yeah, I agree. And I would actually say, watch Lights Out, honestly. I mean, it's a very different animal, but I like the idea of pairing two films that started as shorts and then found success later as features. And it's scary. It's got like a really great simple conceit that is used in a number of really sort of exciting and unexpected ways. It's a little more jump scary, I will confess, but I still like it. But yeah, I think anything in general from Mike Flanagan, I think most of his movies are pretty solid. Absentia's pretty good. Before I Wake is pretty good. Gerald's Game, it's all right. I didn't realize until I started researching this that he was doing Dr. Sleep. And also is doing that Haunting of Hill House series, which I had been really down on because it's not going to be based on the book. But now I'm interested in it again because he is directing, I think, like, the whole thing. Like, he's deeply involved in this Netflix series, The Haunting of Hill House. So, that's like, it's just kind of an interesting thing to know that he is he's the creator on that one. So yeah, maybe I guess check that out, because it's coming out, ostensibly, since these are going to be airing throughout the month of October, it will either be about to come out or already be out.
Awesome.
So there you go. All right. Thank you very much for joining me, Jamie. Where can people find you online? Where can they find your work, and where can they follow you on social media?
Sure. So my YouTube series, you can find at needsmoregay.com. You can also follow me on Twitter @Rantasmo, RANTASMO.
And my name is Daniel Roth, and you can find all of my work at sci-fi.com, and you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Danny Ordinary. That is Danny with one N, Ordinary also with one N. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please make sure that if you have not subscribed to it, that you have, and make sure also that you give it a review. And check out the other Sci-Fi Wire podcasts, Who Won the Week, which is my other one, because I do a lot of podcasts, and also Strong Female Characters, the Winona Earp podcast, and The Fandom Files with features editor Jordan Zacharin. And as we leave you, please remember, sometimes the best cure for the horrors of every day is a little everyday horror. Thanks for listening.